conversation with Miss Lucy Thornton, Miss Jean Wheeler, Mr. Ezell Blair, and now for this tape, Mr. Vincent, and Miss Schneider, right? Miss Wheeler, you read the quotation again from Arnold Rose,
yes,
on the matter of the Negro history movement and possibility of delusion.
Now, two things are important. One is that I do think there's a significant Negro history movement in the sense of a propagandist movement. I think there have been scholarly works. I think that Frazier, John Hope Franklin are good examples of good Negro historians. And I don't think that's what Mr. Rose is referring to. As far as the kind of thing that you find in, say, Negro periodicals, stuff like this is what we used to be, I don't think that the information hits people hard. Maybe one good reason being that it's not of sufficient scope to hit hard. One article once a month can't make a lot of difference. Now, especially in the South, I don't think there's been any kind of Negro history movement. People I met in Albany and in Greenwood were starved to know what happened before 1950. You know, they knew we were in slavery and so on, but to name Negro writers, I don't think you could have gotten many people to name a couple of Negro writers to name to tell you who Addicks was and so on. So I would say that the man's criticism is a good guidepost for people who are going to bring the history to these people, because it is the necessary part of developing a spirit of movement among people, that we can avoid the problems he suggests. But I don't think that they exist, because I don't think that there is a large-scale propagandist Negro history movement. That's my thing.
Mr. Blair, do you want to talk on that for a moment?
So far, the Negroes in the delusion, have the delusion about...
That's not exactly what Mr. Rose said. That's really, that passage that we quoted. This danger of history as propaganda breeding delusion.
Well, I think to a certain extent now, Negroes, ever since the Reconstruction period, most of the history books dealing with the Reconstruction period of America have been somewhat one-sided, that of the most of the white historians. And they haven't given too much credit to Negroes. In my state, North Carolina, I always hear of the dark days of black Reconstruction. But in John Hope Franklin's book, From Slavery to Freedom, he seems to give a different point of view. Now, at my school, in college, it's mandatory that all students who are in education or social science or related fields take Negro history. And this is the book we study, John Hope Franklin. I don't think it's propaganda. I think instead, and maybe if it is propaganda, it's a good thing that Negroes get this. Because it's not, I don't think Franklin is the type of historian who is deluding anybody to the facts concerning the part of the role of Negroes.
But his reputation is very solid, of course.
It's very solid. And I think this is what we need as a group to build pride within ourselves as to the contribution that we pay to America. I think a certain amount of propaganda is needed. After all, 300 years almost of injustice, I think it's about time we begin to see those of us who have played a part in American society on a role.
Mr. Blair, have you read Du Bois' Black Reconstruction?
No, I have not read it.
Have you read Van Woodward's work on Reconstruction?
No, I haven't.
Oh, have you read the... this isn't an examination, but I'm just curious to know...
Yeah, well,
I know Black.
You know... That one I know pretty
well. You know Van Woodward's Strange Career of Jim Crow? Of that book?
Yeah.
I gather you did something you said earlier, but you read that. I assume you got what you said earlier. That whole revaluation of the Reconstruction is one of the late developments of history. Well, I mean, Du Bois was not with, almost alone, you see. It was not a general revaluation. It didn't have such an immediate effect.
Oh, you mean it's you didn't
you see, the effect now, it's in only the last, in the last few years that this has become a matter of he was a voice alone, you see, for years and years and years.
Okay, that's smart.
That's what I mean. And the reevaluation as a general general matter now is fairly recent. I should say it's in the last 20 years. He was alone. He was almost alone in it.
But the greatest criticism I could make of Black Reconstruction and the people that I respect could make was that, the significant thing about it is the information.
You mean the book, Lady Boy?
Yeah. That is, the information is there. Now you're going to have to read around some Marxist reinterpretation. But if you can read around that, then you've got more meat there than you're likely to find in most history books, and therefore the book is worthwhile. Now that's my understanding of how it goes, and I can't make a generalization about the reconstructing of Reconstruction, but I would see that as a very valuable contribution, even with that reinterpretation that you have you have to deal with.
I think Du Bois' book is a great book. It's a great monumental work. I mean, my own opinion of the book. But I first, it's a great rhetorical thing, too. Great piece of writing.
I'm close to posterity.
It probably will be. No, I was thinking in terms of some of the latest historical writings, which I've, in fact, come across. They've been writings, people who are new in the field of history or who just gotten their doctorate or gotten their master's, who have dared to delve into subjects which have probably never been researched and covered before or have been covered and left on the shelves of their universities unnoticed. And they've gone into details as to what might have appeared to be just an ordinary American historical occurrence. And now they go into it and say, yes, there was a Negro involved here, and here's how. I have the facts and figures to prove it. Well, George Washington, I'm just using this as an example, of course, I have no proof of this. While George Washington said one of his aides was a darkie. Now, I know about that man, and the historian has some way of checking it down. And some of these historians are Negroes and are able, I guess, using whatever fragmentary documents are available and whatever can be now recreated, they have rewritten, I guess, what has been left out of the history all along, so it might seem fairly delusive to a person looking at that. It would, of course, put some pride in a youth when he reads a book, say, like Walls's, The Black Man or the Negro's Involvement in the American Revolution. He finds out that, after all, there were all of these Negroes involved in the American Revolution, and I thought that Christopher Actress was just an isolated incident, so that he does get the impression that even at that day, Negroes were involved, and that the story is now bringing us to the forefront.
Let's turn to another topic for a moment. I'll use a quotation again to start us on this. This is a quotation. Negroes of wealth and education, whose only barrier to unrestricted participation in the complete life of the community is the fact they are Negroes, probably constitute the largest single class of social neurotics. That is, life is fantasy for them, God's reality. Does that make any sense? I'll read it again.
Yeah. I think that's good.
I think that makes some sense, Ms.
Lila? I think there's a lot in it. I agree. I think that the Cadillacs and the endless parties that are support of it. But I think that if I had to make it into a percentage, I would say it was
60% of this kind of people, but that 40% of Negroes with money have had a hard time getting it, and know that they don't have to do now, they would have to do, but for their money and so on, and are conscious enough of it to keep pretty close hold on reality. I think the 60% dominates. I think you see them in the newspapers and so on. But I can't help but remember a friend now that I knew through the older people, in the place I was from, Detroit. And his friend's an old numbers man, and he had a sense of understanding of how people are, of how far they can go and they can be pushed, of what was important. I think, even though he was participating in this culture within the Negro culture, and I think that there's a good number of my, and I'm gonna call it 40%. And I think that out of this 40% come the few who stand up and say, well, I've made it, and I'm going to help the other people. I think Ms. Flaxman Pinkett and Washington. Example. I think she has money and is concerned civically and socially and so on. So I agree with the writer's general statement, but I think that it doesn't have enough flavoring of the people who, even though they have the money, are maybe laughing inside themselves at the antics that everybody's going through. You all wanted to say something?
Yes, Mr. Blair.
Well, certainly what Dee was saying about, I agree with her wholeheartedly. I think Negroes are going through sort of a fantasy in as much as that they have a problem in trying to be, it's an obstacle being a Negro in the community. When you have she said an education and so forth, and then you find that you're a Negro, and then you still have to fall back to the same standards, white, season looking Negroes, all alike. If you once you're a Negro, you're always a Negro. You never change, even though you can have all the education you want. This is the type of people that in the community that I live in. Now, most of them are teachers, or they may be doctors or lawyers and so forth, but they still can't reach the point where they blend in completely with the community. They can't be accepted as being lawyers or doctors, except for being Negro lawyers or doctors. And this seems to bother them. And many of them have expressed to me the opinion that they just don't know where they fit in. They have all the education that they can get. They are professional people, but at the same time, they still be considered Negro. And while they want to get patience, regardless whether Negroes or whites, they're still confused. They don't know where they fit in. So they have to fall back into the position of just taking on Negro positions or teaching Negro schools, and whereas many of them are qualified to teach in or work in positions which have not been heretofore what you might call Negro positions. They're eligible to teach anybody to work in jobs which have not been traditional Negro jobs.
I'd like to just Lucy point.
Yes, Ms. Thornton.
I'd just like to look for a moment at the source of this neurosis, really. In many instances, it's because, as the author has very rightly said, Negro is not accepted into the larger community, but it's also because of the attitude which, as Ezell has pointed out, most of society has towards Negroes in general. And because of this attitude, much of it has, I suppose, gone over to the man whom he has termed the most neurotic group in America, mainly because all of society is saying, within this group, you've got so much that's no good, so much that's unacceptable. And that, in his statement.
But in thinking in terms of the sources,
yes, Ms. Thornton.
Neurosis, I'm thinking the whole of society has a way of looking at a Negro. And when a Negro has gotten to the position where he, quote, has arrived, unquote, and he finds that he has arrived, but arrived where? Who's going to accept him? So I can see why this neurosis would set in, not just because now that he has arrived, he, as a Negro, is still a Negro. He's above what I guess most society thinks is Negro, or what most society thinks is the black man of the country, but yet he knows that the major part of society will not accept him still as a man, so you've got a erotic on your hands.
Well, he lives in his dream of achievement without denying the fact he's not accepted outside. I gather that's the topic.
Yes.
The point that is being made here.
Yes. I could understand very clearly.
You are fine, little silly achievement.
Yes, I can understand a Negro very clearly even making the statement, because many is the time that I've come across Negroes who have, in a sense, bent over backwards to, quote, arrive. And quote, when they've arrived, where are they? Arrived to what? You know, especially if they're willing to, in reaching this point of arrival, forget the fact, or try to forget the fact that they are Negro or black.
On the question of the class structure of the Negro society, we find another quote here. The entire Negro middle and upper class is caught in a dilemma. On the one hand, they find the caste wall blocks their entrance into general white society. On the other hand, they have sometimes a vested interest in a social segregation, which gives them their only the only opportunity they have. But that is, to paraphrase that, and it appears in other, this is theater, by the way.
Yes, I can understand. If you're looking at black Southern society, I guess this is true.
Not just Southern.
You're a Northern, so you would know also what vested interest the Negro leader in the North would have in keeping things as they are. But looking at them from a Southern point of view, I said Southern first, even more so than Northern, because the vested interest which the Negro had in segregation there is that you've got the dualism which goes through all phases of life, from the cradle to the grave, so that you've got a Negro, this is man, who has a chance to thrive. Where in the white society, it's not as clearly defined, and white Negroes can, after all, go some places in town, so that the Negro businessman or the Negro businesses might be extremely limited. They might not have as much of an interest in a segregated society or in a whole system of segregation as the Southern Negro. Because after all, as I said, you've got Southern Negro teachers, and when you stop to look for this class of people to the same degrees, you won't find them in the North, you won't find them in the West, so and the world of segregation is different. Expected, I guess. So I could, I would think that on one side, whereas these same people yearn for all the segregation to, in fact, collapse, they, on the other hand, realize that money-wise, which after all is some standard in this country, this might also mean their ruination to a certain extent.
This is a divided mind, is in certain.
A manifestation of the situation that the Negro middle class people find themselves in is that when people go into a town to organize, you don't start. You start with people who've already demonstrated a certain civic mindedness and so on. But you don't spend your time trying to convince the whole business community or the whole minister community or even part of it that they ought to be on your side, because you know from past experience that ministers, there's going to be two or three ministers and two or three of the new ministers who are going to step up, and there are going to be a few businessmen. The others are going to have to come in when the thing is big enough so that they can't afford not to come in. And it's their interest involved, whether it's, I would say it might not be so conscious, but it's
the great man in the community.
And you know that you're going to be sacrificing. Sacrificing with the change coming.
Do you think there's less of this split between, say, Negro business leaders and the civil rights movement that was a few years ago, having a basis for it? Split between a certain group of successful, in quotes, Negroes, you see, we're talking about upper class, upper middle class, who do not want to be identified with civil rights groups because they are in segregation.
Well,
protected, certainly. Is there less of that now than there was?
Yes.
I think they can afford to voice that.
Right. It's popular now to
be on your
It's popular to be on a movement. Like in Greensboro, North Carolina, for instance, there was a time when Negro leaders would oppose integration because Negroes themselves, on a whole, were not in favor of it. But now, since the idea of integration, desegregation, has come about through the masses of the Negro community, many of them have jumped on the bandwagon and they've gone along with it. And so now you see this outstanding attorney in the community, or this Negro businessman supporting desegregation within the community, or integration, or desegregation of lunch counters, or of jobs and so forth. They come in on it.
Thing is that I think that they recognize too that desegregation is not a real threat to them. I don't think Negroes are going to go outside of the Negro community. As long as we live together, I think we're going to socialize together. I think we're going to pray together and so on. And I think that probably having seen a few integrated situations and having found that Negroes still come back to the cafe and so on because they, I don't know why, I still go back to the cafe. I think that they have seen the realization of the integration and have realized that their interests are not so much in danger as they thought. And I think a further point is that, I had something to say.
Along those same lines, too, I think the same group would realize that what they might, in fact, lose as a result of the walls of segregation coming, probably is lessened to a great extent, not only in what Jean has just said, that is that what they have to offer might, after all, still have a certain validity. Negroes might still want to come to the cafe, but also, because of the society which they've lived in, they've been forced to, in many instances, prepare themselves to greater degrees than people in the other, say, the white society, so that the teacher who once was threatened with possibly losing her job, she's got a master's someplace, Columbia or NYU. I mean, I would feel less threatened by the crumbling of the walls of segregation in that she knows that now that we've got the system itself coming, we're going to be looking at things in terms of who's prepared and not who's white or who's black. So I think less and less there's been a more comfortable feeling on this level in that let it come, I think we can adjust it. I think that the popularity of the movement and the outcry against segregation has probably lessened in this field.
Well, the point I wanted to make was that, this is Jean, the emphasis in some, along with desegregating public facilities, is getting people registered and getting people voting. Now, I don't know why people keep talking about desegregation as the focus of the movement. I think that's surely a part of it. But I say that at least the other, at least on par with that, is efforts to develop a political strength in the South. And the people, the business people, know that when it comes time to find a leader, they're going to be the ones. It's only because the things that they represent are things that Negroes in general want to have. Everybody respects a man's education. Everybody, especially every man. So these business people, I think, can see now maybe gains where they couldn't see before for themselves, because when it comes time to redistrict the town, or when it comes time to send somebody to the state Congress, it's going to be one of them.
I'm kind of blue with you, Gene, because
most of the people in the Negro community realize that even though this is a movement of the masses of people, when it gets down to it, it's going to be those people who get education and training. And this is something that the Negro community looks up to. Invariably, they look up to the man who's had training, but they are skeptical of the man who has trained it and who does not use it to the advantage of the freedom movement at the present. They're skeptical of the Uncle Tom. I think what is involved in the movement is the realization of Negro leaders who have training and who have experience in the political and business life of the community, who are making a sacrifice and who are siding with those now who stand for equal rights and desegregation and the protest movement, as against those who have training and who have knowledge of business and so forth and of the economic welfare community, who have heretofore taken a backward stand, who have sided with the majority of the white community and are keeping the Negro community disfranchised from its rights. I think say for instance, North Carolina and other states, you can expect to see more Negroes enter into the political realm to run the state and national political offices. And you can see Negro masses vote for them. It's the same people, the educated people are still taking over leadership in the movement, but it's seems to be a new image on the part of those educated leaders to realize that they're fighting for the masses of the people, and they should represent the people now instead of representing only a limited number of middle class people within the Negro race.
Let's try this little matter of a vested interest. This is a paraphrase and a quotation I won't distinguish, as given by James Baldwin of the African Congress in Paris some 7 years ago. But you know the passage there, the greatest problem facing us, that is the African Negro, was that we, all Negroes, what would we do among ourselves when there was no longer any colonial horse to ride? That he, Joyce Glidden, pointed out that this was the horse on which a great many Negroes, who were in what he called the skin trade, hoped to rise to power and prestige. Power which would be in no way distinguishable from the power they sought to overthrow. Paraphrase that, the career of anti-colonialists in Africa, but the power can become a power game, not to be distinguished from colonial power in the hand. Now this, can we transfer this to an impossible danger in the civil rights movement, the Negro Revolution? Careerists who will exploit it, and then when it's over, well, what career do they have? Except to maintain it. The interest is to maintain it. That's the interest of keeping it going, rather than suffering. Is that a real danger?
Thank you. Oh. It seems like it's not peculiar. It seems that it's peculiar to no special movement. You know,
right.
I covers, you know, how, I don't mean it especially applies to us, it just applies generally. And I'd say it becomes then a problem of people who are conscientiously involved in it to always scrutinize themselves and their reason and to be very critical of those who do take position. Martin Luther King is criticized. I mean, is scrutinized very closely. And I come up with a positive judgment of it. But I tell you, at least once a week, a bunch of us radicals sit around and make some statement about him as a leader and so on. I think that kind of scrutiny goes on, at least among those who regard themselves as leaders or potential leaders. There's always going to be, I think there's always going to be some kind of, some guard of people who are consciously involved, maybe because they're just young idealists or something, who at least be criticized.
This danger, then, is simply a human danger in all movements.
It's
part of history. Is that right, Mr. Stone?
I would very definitely agree with that. In fact, as you read that, I kept thinking about a little analysis that we used to have in our history courses, the anatomy of a revolution.
I
mean,
when you, Crane Brennan.
Yes. When you analyze any great movement, this is just the kind of danger which is inherent in it, really. And the kinds of successes and failures, it seems to be at least something that you can put into patterns. And I would think that level-headed people aware of the history of this kind of thing can, in fact, at least to a certain degree, maneuver that in a given situation it happens to a lesser degree. But I do think it is a danger, yes.
I'd like to ask a question. I don't know if this fits into the pattern.
Please.
I want to know what you too, Warren, think. Would you call this a revolution of reform or keep people busy or what? I really, like to have you think.
I think it's a matter of, I hesitate because it's a matter of how you're going to use a word.
Would you call it a movement toward a toward broad scale changes in the nature of American society?
No, I wouldn't call it that.
Okay.
As I see it now, and I may change my mind tomorrow, I should say that it's a matter of not changing the essential order of American society, but of absorbing peripheral elements into American society by their own efforts, not by absorbing them as an active society, but by their own efforts entering.
Now, what do you think about the argument that general? Which go, number one, you can't solve the Negro's problem without solving the employment problem. An employment problem can't be solved without solving the problems of how the money, how the economy is, how the money is distributed, for instance, into defense, into maintaining the Cold War.
You can't solve any single social problem singly. Actually, it matters.
But that still doesn't give it a great significance.
No, it means they're tied together, clearly. I mean, how are you going to solve the school problem in Harlem without solving a lot of things about housing and jobs? You know, these things are all... But that doesn't say you shouldn't leave the schools alone meanwhile.
No, but it does give a greater impact to the school effort.
Sure does.
Now, what I'm wondering, I'm not arguing for either side because I've been really wondering a lot lately. Can you say that the momentum given to a particular issue by its relevance to the other issues makes it revolutionary? For instance, can you say that this problem is so deep that and its relationship to these other problems is so tight that nothing's going to be done until they all get done, and that would constitute a basic change in structure of society?
Well, I think we'd have to go back to the actual definitions of what we mean by, say, revolutions opposed to a fundamental reform. Would we call the 1930s a revolution in American society or not?
I think the most revolutionary thing about the whole movement, because I guess after all, when you think of the minority group being accepted and assimilated into American society, maybe this isn't a novel idea. In other words, America has been always has been known as a melting pot, and minorities who catch a hard time eventually make it into the American mainstream. I think the most novel and probably revolutionary is that now you have a black man achieving a kind of self-realization. You have him not only moving into American society, but also standing and saying, yes, I'm willing to come into American society. I've always wanted to be there. In fact, I always have considered myself as being a part of the society, even though you sort of put me over to the side. But on the other hand, I'm standing tall and saying I'm a black American.
In other words, and this is what I was about to say a moment ago, that is, what is not a revolution for a total society may be revolutionary in terms of the Negro society as separated, distinguished logically and otherwise from American society. This represents a real shift of attitude, a revolutionary shift in Negro society, or the Negro group. but its effect on the total society will be a matter of, you might say, a fundamental reform, but will not change the order of society. Does that make it say that we're saying together or not? Is that what you're saying?
Slightly. I had one other thing that hit my mind when I thought also in terms of the black man standing, you know, a self-realization of the black man. I also thought in terms of world order.
Yes.
Because over the centuries now, when you look at how things have stacked up the power structures, more and more this self-realization, I guess it's been in ferment throughout, surely we would say in Europe first, and then it's spread throughout the world. So you've got now the black man in Africa not only realizing or achieving his own goal, standing as the man who will in fact control and rule his homeland, but also you have throughout the world now, and especially in the United States, which the majority of the people are in fact white, you have a black man who's there in that land saying, yes, but I'm a part of the society, and these two things can harmoniously be a part of each other, and the black man can in fact be a part of the whole. He doesn't have to be something that's, he's a problem here, and he's set off to the side. Instead, it's revolutionary for America, too, because after all, I think he's taking the whole of society, or American society, is taking another look at the black man. He's not just something...
That's true, that's true.
...humorous, who's... we accept him, but we don't, or we mainly don't accept him, and he's just here, and he's a thorn in our side, and if we didn't have those ghettos, I think more and more, America itself, you know, taking a look at the black man, and sometimes we appear them to be violent, you know, sometimes we appear anxious and restless, but overall I think they're getting a picture of us, and they're getting a picture, at least they know, no matter what picture they get, that the American Negro intends to be here, and he's fighting to fit into the overall scheme of America. I think that's, and it's revolutionary probably that the black man is doing it in terms of standing up and saying, yes, I'm a black man, but as a black man, I do in fact have something to offer. I don't have to. In fact, this is something that's always puzzled. And Gene, you might be able to help me work it out. I used to argue a good bit with some of my friends.
You turn off the sound.
Yeah, join us. Yeah, some of my friends used to always say, I would go sometimes so far over maybe to the left and saying, talking about the black man and race pride and about what he's achieving and how he's doing it and what we want to do until on the other side I have people who I suppose think they're level-headed when he's speaking to my white friends, for example, who would say, I would think in 25 years, they'd say to me very bluntly, I would think in 25 years you won't have any problem because by then everybody will look pretty much alike because by then we'll have sufficient integrated marriages and you won't be able to speak anymore in terms of the American black man. In other words, you will just have an American and now the Negro is something like fighting to be a part of that America. And what he'll do eventually is to lose himself, lose his identity, lose everything. And what puts me like that is that somehow it doesn't sound quite like
how's the day never come for the Negro's identity, but for what many American sociologists say, in 100 years' time, or maybe less, many Negroes won't be Negroes anymore. Instead of being dark, color, woozy, I was just trying to call them mulatto. Everybody will be mulatto, and so it'd be difficult to tell who's Negro, who's not Negro. I think one time I was in favor of the integrated, that you know, everybody's like one person. But then the older I get and as time passes, I'm getting to realize that there are certain things called, like I said, racial pride or having a feeling that you are what you are. And even though you are in the culture, you have certain characteristics like the Jewish people, for instance. Then they are in American culture, but they still preserve this identity that they have had over thousands of years. And I think this is something that Negroes as a whole should do. And I realize that we're interracial marriage, not interracial marriage, but
you might call concubines in today's language. There have been many Negroes, for instance, who are gifted for placement. And eventually, these traits may bring about a person who is called a Negro, but who is so fair and perplexing that it'd be difficult to tell a Negro from white. This will eventually come about. But until that time, Negroes need to feel proud within themselves.
What is a Negro?
At a time, we might become a lost race or something. Well, American Negro. That's something, too, this fight of terms. What is a Negro? I have friends who would prefer not to be called Negroes. I'm not a Negro. Mainly, I'm a black man. To some others, I'm not colored. Don't call me colored, you know. And very vehemently, you know. Negro is simply something they've attached to me, and I won't have it. You know, I'm just another man, or... You know, you get these reactions over and over again to, of course, some of them, I must admit, come from the feeling that the name Negro attaches a stigma to the person.
That's the worst. That's the nicest of the names.
Yeah, that is the nicest of all those that they call it, but in fact, Negro has such a stigma to it until
it simply means black, doesn't it?
Negro at all.
Well.
No, it doesn't mean much more than
that.
I think Negro.
It's accumulated
out of
meanings, perhaps.
Yeah, but the accumulation of it is very significant.
And that's probably where the reaction comes in.
Yeah. Everything associated with black people in this country. You're born in a major black neighborhood, let's say we get black is specifically evil. People die and they're buried and a coffin is white. Everything that's right is white. If it's purity is white, if you go to heaven, you see a white God. This type of thing. Even if you're an angel, the angel is white and just in a white robe, and you're going to be drinking milk and honey, and you're flowing down the street, all pretty gold and everything. This is the image that Negro constantly has to face. And this is the image that I have faced in growing up in American society. Even a black cat is considered to be evil. Everything white is pure. So you begin to wonder. You say, well, what am I? You see, you feel like Ralph Ellison says, you're an invisible man. Nobody even sees you. You're just existing.
Do you think it's a true definition or a true statement? I don't know. It might be misquoting somebody, but I've always been saying, nobody knows me. Nobody knows my name. They call me that, but I know the man that I am.
I ain't got nobody. Nobody knows me.
I think the definition. I say
that's good.
I say that a Negro in the United States is anybody who is a tint of color, who is less than white looking. Yeah, I think it's the appearance that you put on the cushion. Who is less than white looking and who cannot prove that he's of another race. Like any time I see a
Indian.
Yeah.
Put those in. Indian or Puerto Rican.
Yeah.
They're not Negro.
I know, but whenever I see a Puerto Rican in New York, until I find out that he has an accent, I think he's a Negro. That's what I'm trying to say. If he can show that he's something else, then it's all right. But as long as he's anything less than white, then he's a Negro.
I think we're caught in this terrible bind because I have friends who are from Virgin Islands, from Louisiana, other countries, and right away, sometimes going down. It's so funny how when you're taught this kind of thinking, you go down the street and say, that's a Negro. Oh, no, he's not a Negro. That's a white. In other words, somehow Negroes think they can tell other Negroes. And then my friends in Latin America, for example, say, I don't see how you can speak that way because in my country, this person could be black, typical. I mean, we've never called him in America anything but a Negro. But to the natives from his country, they would prefer not to attach a name Negro or anything else because part Danish, part Spanish, part... And you start naming all these things, you say, well, how could that be Negro when Negro in the United States means something quite different?
But until he comes up with that accent, he's a Negro.
Actually, the legal definition of Negro has changed from time to time in this country, Virginia. It has gradually gone less and less folks' Negro blood required to make a person legally a Negro. This is about statutes. Gradually, it decreased the amount of Negro blood was fixed first legally. Now it's gotten to a point in Virginia, if I know the law right, where any demonstrable proportion is 3/4, something like that.
Our law also used to go as far as even if he's got 1/8 of a drop of Negro blood. I think that might even, something about the drops of blood might still read into the language, because I remember once going into court and the charge was that we sat in some place which was supposed to, by law, be segregated, Negroes and whites in different positions, and our attorney got up and said, I want you to prove that my clients are Negroes. Of course, we looked like we were from every country but the United States, and some people were clearly, you know, not obviously Negroes, and you read off the statute.
Well, I don't know about you all, but my great-grandfather was white.
Mine too, you fought the Civil War.
Well, I won't tell you about mine.
Which side?
I don't know.
My brother.
I'm going to tell him his grave if he can see me now, though.
My brother used to take some kind of, I don't know whether it was pride or anything else, I think he used to try and stir up his class. He used to say to them, one of my relatives on my grandfather's side, not too far down the line, a few generations back, he used to be president of the United States. I just kill him right away. They started telling me right quick, that's your brother means. I know he always says that he's of European descent. I mean, he started talking that way. You know. I'm sure everybody in Virginia would be shocked if they heard him say that, you know.
May I change the subject a little bit? James Baldwin says this: the most trenchant observers of the scene in the South, those who are embattled there, you all, feel that the Southern mobs are not an expression of the Southern majority will. Their impression is that these mobs fill, as it were, a moral vacuum.
I don't believe that.
Miss Wheeler?
I have sat in, well, in the jail and later, in the field, in the evening, cooling outside, and wondered how could any whole group of people hate me that much. I've never seen a mob like it. But everywhere I went down south, I didn't feel it so much. Okay, I successfully had a fence around me before I went down there.
Being Washington, D.C., you mean?
And Detroit.
And Detroit.
I
live
very nice in Detroit. Everywhere I went, I just had a continual, unless I was high just surrounded, and I even had a continual feeling that there was a white person around the corner waiting for me to step the wrong way to hit me. I didn't ever feel like that policeman was an exception. I thought that he was the generalization of things. All those people that lived across Oglethorpe Street, you know, or downtown, across on the other side of downtown. And I might not speak for, I'm really just speaking for me, but I never had a feeling when I talked to people when I would canvass, say, trying to get people registered to vote. An easy subject of
Where was this?
In Albany, Georgia.
Yes.
In Greenwood, Mississippi. An easy subject of conversation is, yeah, those white folks sure hate us. And we could talk about that for hours. And I don't think it was just a few. I don't think they thought it was just the mob. I really don't. I think they thought it was just every one of them that ever lived.
I think it was kind of fun, too. On the other side, it seems a fashionable thing, too, even if you had any kind of feelings. Any good feelings about Negroes or any feelings at all about demonstrations, I suppose the most fashionable thing is just to keep them inside you and pray that something will change one day. I suppose I'm really just somehow imposing, empathizing with a white Southern. I'm just trying somehow on the other side, thinking that if they had these feelings, then there might, and keep them with the author, there might be some majority, but the manifestations of this feeling, I mean, the feeling that's different from the mob, are so slight and so few and far between until a person within himself saying, God forgive me, or saying, if I have wounded any soul, you know, and knowing full well you helped everybody step on top of every Negro you saw on sight, doesn't help me. So, and the more you do this kind of thing, the more guilt you get within yourself, and less of a chance there is for the white individual to come across on the other side, I would think. And, of course, these things probably come up within the white person from his birth on up, I guess, even from within the society. He has learned a certain way, and most people are such social beings until they want to react and be just as their society demands, and few want to rebel against it, so that if the mob is not representative, in fact, of what the majority of the people are, the fact that the majority sits back and solemnly okays it or looks on, and every once in a while is ashamed, and only when the most blatant things happen, says to itself, this has to change. And then on the other side of his mouth says, oh yes, it has to change, but you know, they are a little radical, far too radical. And I mean, on one side he's hoping for the safety and security of what he knows to be white society, even if that means okay in the mob or sitting back silently and watching it happen. So that if you've got this feeling overall, it'll take, the manifestations of it aren't very, very encouraging, I would say. You've got some people who dare speak out against it, and as natives, when they do, usually, they are ousted from the society, and the rest of the society realizes this, so that the other souls who, again, would speak know of the examples. They know people have, in fact, not been accepted in the society. And it's just fashionable, if this is any kind of majority feeling, not to manifest it. And when you don't manifest it, you really don't have it in a sense. I know people who say, of course, in some cases, it's the kind of thing that an attitude or a kind of feeling which has grown up without any basis at all. For example, I remember once talking with a group of Southern white college kids who had, I mean, the kinds of things which happened in our little meetings where white Southerner had never talked to black Southerner. You know, kids who suddenly realized that, you know, like everything I learned in my society, I used to stand back on the corner too and say, there goes a nigger, you know, and get him, and he's no good, and yes, they're disease, yes, they're everything. Suddenly I realized that this is another man's thing, and the kinds of feelings which well up into a person, but they're still, in many instances, victims of their society. They know, and they're practical men, you know, and they know what it's going to mean if they dare to say to the mob, go home, don't do it today. You know, they might be mobbed along with a Negro. And most people talk about self-preservation, and this is one area where self-preservation really stands out quite big. So that.
Let me just break in here a moment. Miss Thornton, when I sat by you at lunch back in November, the first thing, if my memory doesn't trick me, that you said, well, you had some optimism for a settlement in the South, that you that the white man and the Negro had been on the land together. They had a common history, which is some basis of a reasonable settlement, some human recognition in terms of this common history, despite the violence of the present situation. That this gave you some optimism for a settlement in the South that would be reasonable. You also said, if I remember correctly, and it was your saying, so your memory is better than mine on it, that you were frightened of the big anonymous situations in, say, Chicago, Detroit, New York, which cities you named. Is my memory playing me false on that?
No, you're almost all correct. Almost, yeah. I was also thinking then in terms of the something which I guess many Southerners have tried to, or people who call themselves Southerners, white or black, have tried to place their hands on, and some people are segregated out as being.
Well, to gain the ability to
gave me the right to vote. You know, isn't it real block to all of this economic block? Isn't it really a economic advantage for the poor, for anybody white in a town where there's only a piano factory and say a few other small industries like cleaning and so on? In a town like that, if there are so few jobs, it doesn't just make sense that to just start off excluding 40% of the population to put yourself in a better position.
Given that situation, yes, but
and that's
there's a great
that's a common that's not unusual.
Yes, but there's a great general argument that segregation has cost the country vast sums of money.
We're talking about how much country telling one little city is not deserving itself.
All right, one little city or one little town, yes. But an overall picture, which would give an economic logic for integration, rather than economic logic for segregation. Now, this is it's long for to indicate, to communicate this, the man is fighting for his job, you know, in that particular moment down the street. But this overall social argument is there, and I should hope that more and more people understand about it.
But again, I think it's more than worth mentioning that it's that we're talking about a local situation.
Yes.
And if this man hasn't even been accompanied thinking outside of the Delta, say, or certainly not outside of Mississippi, that to conceptualize himself as part of the United States is quite a step. And to realize that there are other countries in the world that aren't necessarily bad, I think, would be hard for most of them. Well, for most of that.
Let me tell you what Mr. Evers said to me on this recording session a few weeks ago. I asked him about Mississippi. I'll make it brief. He said, I have some optimism here that one thing, these segregations, many of them, are raised on some respect for courage. That's in their tradition. Said once that they recognize that the Negroes standing up and showing courage and facing him down, you have a kind of respect that there is a working basis for a settlement. And this respect is just straight, raw courage, which is in the local tradition. He said, the other thing is, once he crosses a line and sits down to talk with you to make an agreement, he's probably going to tell you the truth. See, I prefer dealing with him than dealing with man up, no, slap you on the back, say, I'm really on your side. That's an almost direct quote from Stanley Charlton.
I agree with him on that statement. Yeah, Joe Clay, I agree with him on that statement. Inasmuch when we started the settler movement in 1960, we met the mayor of Greensboro, we met representatives from, I think, from the Southern Region Association associated with Woolworth stores. And they told, and this, these representatives, the mayor of Greensboro and this representative from Woolworth told us the same thing. They were straightforward when they found out that we weren't going to back down. They asked us, they told us that we were giving Greensboro a bad name so far as the city was concerned, and that this would hurt the city economically wise. And we told them we weren't going to move, and then this gentleman told us, he said, well, he respected that. He came across, he told us, he said, well, look, he said, we aren't worried so much about you starting trouble. He said, what we're worrying about is the poor whites starting trouble. He said, the fighting and so forth. We know that you're going to be nonviolent. And then this was a great shock to me because this is the first time where I ever come in contact with the middle class, the upper white, or the upper whites in the community, admitting that the poor whites would cause trouble. And this is where I think he really came through in telling the truth on the matter.
I know
he was the basis of it. This was a plot to keep the Negroes and white poor whites from apart from each other, you know. This is a standard plot, I realize
that. Why would that be the truth then?
I mean, but this is the first time where I ever heard a white man admit to his guilt. He was admitting the truth for once and for all. He would admit this to us, you know. But he wouldn't go down in the white section, the poor white section, and tell the poor white people this, you see.
And he would tell
the
poor white people about you niggas.
I know, this is it. I realize what he was doing.
Well,
how's it come out to be true,
yes,
Miss
Bell?
He was telling on himself. The way I figured, he was telling on himself.
It's an indirect telling on himself.
It's indirect telling on himself.
That doesn't make it true.
That, I'm afraid, is not what Mr. Edwards was talking about.
Excuse me a second.
We've got to change tapes. This is the end of tape two of the conversation with Miss Wheeler, Miss Thornton, Mr. Blair. See tape three.
I don't...